This is another podcast from my newsletter, Reflections on Technology, Media and Culture. I put my energies into thinking, reading and writing. I have little left for recording and editing an audio version. So I'm taking the easy way out. As usual, I've cloned my own voice using 11 Labs and then run the text through its text-to-speech generator. Opinions about such a practice vary. Looking at Reddit, most criticisms focus on the idea of using AI to produce the script as well as the audio. If you are going to ask AI to generate both the content and its presentation, then you may as well dispense with the author. I'm not ready yet to be dispensed with. So here is my article, read, perhaps falteringly, by my cloned voice. I welcome your feedback. This is not the age of AI. It's June 16th, 2026. This title, This is Not the Age of AI, emerges not from any skepticism I might hold about AI, but from skepticism about the idea of an age at all. I'm revisiting my post from 2014, Zeitgeist Busters, number 201, in which I vented skepticism about the idea of the spirit of an age. Some social commentators like to sum up large swathes of human experience with a prevailing mood, condition, or age, to which one can attach a compelling title. For example, I wrote later about the idea of a post-digital age in a post titled, When Did We Become Post-Digital? Such identifications, becoming post-digital, for example, serve various purposes. It is not just that I personally feel bored, disconnected, or sufficiently competent with digital technology that I want to abandon it as a category. I also like to think that this is a condition shared by some larger majority. There is solidarity and comfort in elevating one's own state of mind, even if it is a minority view, into something global and epical. I'm bored, so everyone must be bored. That kind of thing. The phrase post-digital age also serves to unsettle audiences animated by a fear of missing out, FOMO, on some new trend. Writers, speakers, and would-be influencers garner prestige from channeling such anxieties. Brain rot. I asked ChatGPT to source some recent claims about the age in which we find ourselves. Apart from a reference to the age of AI, these were mostly negative. The age of grievance, the age of rage bait, the age of brain rot, the age of enshittification, and the age of polycrisis. The sources included dictionaries that identify a word of the year, consultancies reporting on public mood, risk agencies that diagram overlapping crises, and think tanks that identify anxiety, grievance, distrust, and disruption. The Zeitgeist label feeds press releases, memes, and slides in keynote presentations. The AI elaborated as follows. Rage bait captures the monetization of irritation. Brain rot names a familiar anxiety about attention and triviality. Enshittification gives comic precision to the deterioration of online services, once promoted as liberating infrastructures. Polycrisis gives form to the sense that crises no longer arrive one at a time. Insofar as such labels catch on, they provide partial, vivid, and contestable tropes by which to express, address, or promote particular anxieties. The Zeitgeist survives less as a shared mood than as a recurring rhetorical device, a way of exaggerating the present so that it becomes available for thought and persuasion. If we want to stick with the age of trope, then perhaps this is the age of naming the age. We are not all of the age. Such formulations presume to speak for the condition of everyone everywhere. The ubiquity of smartphones, platforms, and online media seems at first to support such generalizations. It is tempting to think that a connected planet shares a connected mood. But access to devices and networks does not produce a common social condition. Insular communities form around particular points of view, frames of reference, languages, geographies, material conditions, patterns of exclusion, and relations to media technologies. Even where the same platforms are present, they don't engender the same experience. The phrase age of grievance, for example, has one meaning within affluent democracies marked by distrust of institutions, polarized media, and populist resentment. It has another, more acute meaning for people whose grievance concerns bereavement, displacement, military occupation, drone strikes, or the destruction of basic infrastructures. Brain rot presupposes a world of optional consumption, attention management, and overabundant media. It has little purchase where communities lack basic educational provision, reliable electricity, or safe access to communications. Polycrisis names an elite view of overlapping systems. Climate, war, finance, migration, health, and technology. But those living through crisis likely experience their condition not as a plural abstraction, but as a singular emergency. Hunger, bombardment, debt, drought, illness, exile. Zeitgeist labels do not only exaggerate, they universalize the anxieties of particular groups, often those already well represented in media and commentary. They convert situated discomfort into epical pathology. Their usefulness lies not in telling us what age we are in, but in revealing who has the authority, confidence, and platform to name the age. The question is not, what is the zeitgeist? The question is, who gets to declare one? Postscript. I'm attempting to review earlier posts in the order in which they appeared. I have skipped over two. How bored is your dog? Number 199, and mood and movement. And trams, number 200. The first of these references the use of a consumer level head-worn EEG device, that is, electroencephalography, in an art context involving analog sound sources. Amongst other innovations, that project demonstrated an unself-conscious use of mixed analog and digital media. Insofar as such categorizations pertain, one might describe that as an example of a post-digital event. A brief scan online of AI-based interactive artworks shows that such experiments and provocations continue irrespective of any age labels. The second post, Mood and Movement and Trams, identified travel as an influence on mood. Extending the propositions listed in that article, travel serves as a kind of zeitgeist buster. Not least, it can deny globalizing labels by highlighting differences amongst communities and places, so long as we look beyond our tourist bubble. That ends the current article. Here is the original article from 2014. Zeitgeist Busters, 21st June 2014. Turn on, tune in, drop out. That was the spirit of the late 1960s, the mood of those times, their zeitgeist. What about the current age? Everything is a copy. So Tonighten replaces Turn On. iTunes is the new Tune In. And Dropbox replaces Dropout. At a time when everyone would rather be elsewhere, turn off, drop everything, and turn up late also serves as a mood mantra. This is also the spam age. Sifting through unwanted emails ruins the flow of work and personal communications and messes it up for everyone. spoilers rule, hate tweets, phishing, inflammatory emails. As well as online business, the internet is taken over by unfinished business. Incomplete projects clog up servers, along with unanswered emails, unread tweets, dead links, links never clicked, untended comment fields, not to mention unfulfilled entrepreneurial ambitions. It is the age of the lazypreneur. It is also the age of antisocial media. A generation has emerged of people who are exercised less by the possibilities offered by the internet's newness than by expecting it simply to deliver what they want. Some try to evade its hegemony, to go undetected, or simply give up on any notion of personal privacy. This is, after all, a post-digital age. Zeitgeists come and go with such rapidity and specificity that they are really just fads. With so many channels of information, Zeitgeist gets replaced by what is trending. This is the age of the broken Zeitgeist. Zeitgeist revisited. But what if there really is no prevailing mood of a time? At best, the claim to have identified it is a convenient fiction, an acknowledged gross generalization, a provocation, an overstatement to bring into consciousness something strange that would otherwise pass unnoticed. At worst, the idea of the Zeitgeist assumes that everyone is in the same condition, that what counts is what is pervaded by mass media and its online extensions, and that human society is uniform across the planet, drifting from one state of consensus to another. In the old Hegelian sense of Zeitgeist, it also implies the presence of prophets and elites who have the genius capacity to detect, express, influence, and advise on the current mood. But thanks to the internet, we all have a voice now, whether or not anyone is listening. Notes. First, "Turn on, tune in, drop out" is attributed to Timothy Leary. Second, what I have outlined here is well known to historians and philosophers of history. This is historicism, a concern with the peculiarities of a time and place in which events unfold, and with the character of a community. A historicist thinks it is the job of the scholar or cultural critic to penetrate the essential spirit of a country or period. Third, in my discipline of architecture, historicism treats interpretation and history as processes of uncovering the grand idea. Great architecture gives expression to the spirit, mood, and aspirations of a people, and history presents it as such. Fourth, historicism is largely attributed to German idealism, exemplified in the historical theorizing of Johann Gottfried von Herder, Wilhelm von Humboldt, Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, Leopold von Ranke, and Friedrich Schleiermacher. We discuss the issue in relation to hermeneutics in the introduction to Adrian Snodgrass and Richard Coyne's Interpretation in Architecture, Design as a Way of Thinking, published by Routledge in 2006. I include here the two other articles referenced in the current post. How bored is your dog? June 7th, 2014. People have tried EEG on pumpkins, melons, and dead fish. There is no real evidence that it works on dogs, but it was worth a try. The dominant reading for Jasmine was excitement. This blog post is co-written with PhD student Dorothea Kalogiani. Electroencephalography, or EEG, is a fascinating technology that measures the intensities of the key frequencies at which the human neural system propagates electrochemical signals. Head-worn EEG devices are relatively inexpensive and are now used in all kinds of test environments to record how people feel while watching movies, playing computer games, and making consumer choices. Brainwave intensities seem to correlate with a person's general affective state, that is, their emotion or mood. We are using an EEG headset supplied by Emotive. Emotive also provides software that filters and processes these wave intensities to indicate how engaged the wearer is in some stimulus. Low engagement also means a high level of boredom. The device also picks up on whether the wearer is in a meditative state, excited, or frustrated. Brain artists. A group of students known as the Brain Drain Group performed at an installation in Edinburgh College of Arts, We Red Bar, on 29th May 2014. Alvin, as brain artist, was rigged with the EEG device and required simply to sit for 30 minutes in a comfortable chair. Around him were positioned custom-made instruments for generating electromechanical sounds. The screen behind Alvin showed a dynamic geometrical image that altered according to his mood state as picked up by EEG. Engagement, meditation, frustration, and excitement, while music technologist Robbie operated the instruments. Later that evening, two laptop performers, Dara Etefagi and Timo Preece, composed in real time an extended sound duet, as Alvin's brain silently performed the role of mood critic. See the note below about Alvin's emotional response to the different experiences. This event was the culmination of a series of experiments linking brain and performance, organized by Dorothea Calogiani, with a team that included Robbie Christie, Chiangqian Hu, Ze Chao, Alvin, Li, Asuka Kanetake, Donghui Xie, Marina Papagiani, and Wolfgang Thomas, students and practitioners of digital media, sound design, acoustics, and music technology. There is a video explaining the project in more detail. Notes. First, see the Brain Drain project website. Second, also see external sites such as No More Woof. Do plants have feelings? And what a dead fish can teach you about neuroscience and statistics. Third, also see blog posts tagged brain. Fourth, we spoke to Alvin after the We Red Bar event. As verified by the EEG display, he was more excited and frustrated by Timo and Dara's performance, as it was entirely new to him. That concludes the first of the two articles. Mood and Movement and Trams, 14th of June, 2014. The trams are running in Edinburgh after 6 years of construction, stalls, and turmoil. It's a nice ride, described well in a recent post by blogger Gillian Somerville Arjat. It doesn't shoogle or wobble and hurtle you about with sudden braking as the buses do. I think of gliding down Princes Street on a tram as something like being in a mood. First, constancy. Words with an oo sound in them, depending on the surrounding consonants, sound smooth, like the nonsense word booba. People who have found their groove, have a smooth ride, are on the move, and are easily soothed. Whether good or bad, a mood is a condition with some constancy, like a gliding tram. Whoosh. Second, sensory engagement. There are many sounds associated with movement, and rapid movement activates the sensorium in ways that a stroll does not. Think of a dog sticking its head out of a car window and gulping at the wind. Travel is a mood changer or amplifier. Third, comfort. Traveling well means being safe and feeling safe, cocooned in a gliding refuge. Some people like being locked in a metal tube with others in control, attended to, coddled and fed drinks and snacks, as on a plane or train. To travel, you have to be isolated from the effects of speed, the roughness of the weather, water and other extremes. There is security in that, and perhaps contentment conducive to a meditative state. Fourth, sociability. The economics of travel requires that people congregate. Travel means there is always something to talk about, as the view changes, and someone to talk with, if you want that. It may even encourage sociability or tactics to remain isolated, for example, during rush hour. Fifth, variation. Fast travel inevitably takes you through different places and across thresholds between places. It makes many things the same, but also renders transition effects obvious, as when you pass from the city to the countryside, exit a tunnel, or turn a corner. There is excitement in that. Sixth, prospect. Travel that is faster than walking reveals new prospects. So some people prefer to ride on the top deck of a double-decker bus. Planes provide obvious prospect, especially when close to the ground and you can see things. Trains and trams do it too. Now I know what a switchback is. Seventh, parallax. The foreground appears blurred and the distance comes into sharp relief. Apparently, this is an example of the ethics of disappearance, according to Paul Virilio. Geometers and photographers know that movement makes certain spatial relationships obvious and occludes others. Eighth, connection to the ground and sky. Trams hug the road surface. Planes hang from the sky. In either case, fast travel privileges the sky in the visual field. This relates to parallax and to vertigo. Ninth, anticipation. There is a destination in mind. Expectant moods pervade travel in prospect and while on the move. Tenth, flight and fright. You can see it in a passenger's expression. Interrupted progress frustrates them. Movement is part of what it is to have an emotion, according to William James. 11th, distance traveled. The tram ride to Edinburgh Airport takes 35 minutes, but it brings to mind longer journeys, and there is melancholy in that. 12th, excursion and return. You have to come back at some stage. See the blog post titled Oblivion. Bibliography: Cristalia Canvasino, Notation Timelines and the Aesthetics of Disappearance, published in the Journal of Architecture in 2010. Richard Koech, Shinescapes, Cinematic Spaces in Architecture and Cities, published in 2013. Paul Virilio, Speed and Politics, an essay on dromology, published in 1986. And Paul Virilio, The Aesthetics of Disappearance, published in 2009. Notes. First, search online for Bubakiki to read about OO, sounding words like Google. Second, thanks to John Lee for referring me to Gillian Somerville Arjat's post. Third, it's interesting that the Happy Planet Index test of the New Economics Foundation asks standard mood and lifestyle questions, but also inquires about how you travel. Walking is good for you and the planet. A few long holidays are better than lots of weekend breaks that involve getting on a plane. A trip to Australia blows your share of the planet's resources by 2.5 times through the flight alone. I think trains are good. Fourth, in an interesting book on cinema and the city, Richard Koch notes, in probing the relationship between the city and the moving image, the question of movement and mobility, and by extension, that of time and rhythmicity, reinforces the essentially dynamic affective, and emotional properties of urban space. That is another link between mood and movement. Insofar as we experience the city cinematically, we participate in both the movement and the emotional power of cinema. That concludes my newsletter for today. Thank you for your attention.